My name is Frank Myers. I'm the chair of this panel. Welcome to the panel on class issues in history. I'm not Bill Miller. On your panel, it says Bill Miller. Bill couldn't do it for some reason. It was Mike's wife, who's organizing the conference, came to me. I teach in the political science department here at Southern Program here for a long time as a professor in the political science department. But that's all you need to know about me. The important people are sitting here to my left, and they are the ones who are going to be running the panel, essentially. My job is simple. It is to keep them to 15 minutes approximately each. Everybody understands that. I'll do my best. And to allow time for you to ask questions when it's over. So I'll begin right away. Our first panelist is going to be Gregory Wood, right?
Okay. Yes.
I'll just say a few words to introduce him to you. He teaches 20th century history, United States history at Frostburg State in Maryland, right?
Yes.
And his specialties include social, labor, cultural, and gender history. He received his PhD at the University of Pittsburgh in 2006. And on the Frostburg campus, he coordinates the history internship program and serves as a member of the faculty senate before coming to Frostburg. Greg taught at the University of Pittsburgh, Penn State New Kensington, and Penn State Erie. The title of his paper is pretty intriguing, as a good title should be. It's Smokes on a Train, right? Smoking and Class Struggles on the New York City Subway, 1904 to 1913. I'll let you have it in 15 minutes. Thanks very much.
Thank you. On the afternoon of August 30, 1913, a fight erupted on the platform of the New York City subway at 149th Street and 3rd Avenue. John McBride, an Interborough policeman, ordered William Lindemann to put out his cigar and thereby comply with the Interborough Rapid Transit Company's ban of smoking on the trains and platforms. As the New York Times reported, however, quote, the smoker puffed on and there were words between the two, end quote. The confrontation quickly escalated from words to fists and a, quote, scuffle ensued. The pair rolled on the ground as they fought. To secure Windermere in handcuffs and arrest him, now for assault, Officer McBride needed to call on the assistance of the station manager. The New York Times reported, quote, the smoker struggled at every step, end quote, as the men walked out of the train station into the street. On the street above, onlookers actually intervened and tried to release the handcuffed William Windermere. A small riot was underway. This, quote, battle royal, end quote, featured not only the men who wanted to free Windemere, but also men who tried to give aid to the embattled officer McBride. Observers called for reserves of police. The onrushing policemen scattered the mob into multiple directions. After the fighting finally stopped, after roughly 15 minutes, two men went to jail, a, quote, somewhat battered, end quote, William Windemere, and rioter John Carboy, who had tried to help the accused escape from police custody. On the streets and subways of progressive-era New York, smoking was an intensely controversial issue. The smoking of cigars and cigarettes and efforts to ban these practices not only engendered individual acts of resistance, but also on this occasion, outbursts of collective violence. So here we have a perturbed policeman, a crowded train platform, an enlisted subway employee, an irritated customer, a city of commuters, and in the middle, a lit cigar. Amidst the chaos of the conflict's comings and goings on the subway platform that afternoon, it would seem this may not be the best place to begin a discussion of class relations in early 20th century New York City. Surely, as other scholars have written in the past, the city's sweatshops, tenements, dance halls, and dens of vice would serve as better and more fixed starting points. However, the subject of smoking on the subway exposes new sites in the social histories of class and labor and raises interesting questions about how city dwellers would experience class in their daily lives during the early 20th century. The debates over the smoking of cigars and cigarettes on New York subways produced ongoing commentary in the early 20th century press, providing historians with ways to explore class relations in the context of commuter spaces, zones of mobility, motion, and interaction situated between workplaces and communities. In commuter spaces, smoking controversies underlined familiar class conflicts, but also created new ones. Cigars in hand, for example, affluent upper-class smokers castigated subway workers for pestering them about no smoking rules, and subway workers themselves often neglected their duties rather than absorb rider criticism. Non-smokers lamented how the workings of the company-operated subway failed to protect public health, as subway companies failed to actually ban smoking and keep the air clean. Smokers themselves bristled continuously against subway rules and restrictions, challenging company power directly as consumers of the service. Opened in 1904, subways became important sites, I try to argue, where New Yorkers would experience social class. They required the members of social classes from the world above ground to face one another in the closest proximity. But the social relations of commuting below ground also recombined classes and transformed class relations in ways that both frustrated and surprised New York City residents. And the first section of this paper looks at what I'm calling private interests versus public health. During the 1900s and 1910s, smoking bans became a common feature of the urban and industrial landscape. In factories, private employers, as I explore in other papers, have imposed rules that ban smoking. And at the same time, the New York City subways forbade their workers and customers to smoke. Not confined to enclosed factories and offices, company rulemaking extended from private spaces into the public. While the Interborough Rapid Transit Company, the new subway, was technically owned and operated by the City of New York, it functioned not as an extension of local government, but rather as a separate entity. As a political scientist wrote of New York in 1906, quote, private companies own and operate the surface and elevated trains and also operate the subway or underground railway as far as construction, end quote. Functionally, the IRT was a private business interest, a reality not lost on urban residents. Observers, especially non-smokers, were quick to point out the public health problems ensured by company actions. In November 1904, a letter writer who called himself Sanitary complained to the New York Times that the Interborough Rapid Transit Company did a very poor job of regulating the air used by its customers. Despite rules to the contrary, many riders of the new subway line smoke their cigars and cigarettes, Sanitary complained, quote, cannot the health of the passengers while in the care of the company be protected? Sanitary recalled a dreary 10-minute wait for the subway, where he, she, quote, was obliged to stand on the station platform in an atmosphere of smoke, end quote. As Sanitary suggested, public health was very much in the care of a seemingly private interest. And while rules that ban smoking were in place, they were not always enforced. Anti-smoking letters and editorials from the 1900s, which were quite frequent, actually, in the New York Times, highlighted the theme of customer neglect fostered by what letter writers claimed was a largely disinterested Interborough. In a December 1906 editorial, a writer blamed the Interborough for an apparent ambivalence about the care of customers in their charge. Despite rules against smoking and rubbish on the trains and in the stations, the company responded by claiming it was powerless to completely enforce its own rules. But the writer claimed, quote, when the subway officials say they are in doubt how far they can prevent it being smoking in the room, they are guilty of the bull of the Irishman, who did not know whether he could play the fiddle because he had never tried, end quote. The editorial of December 1906 blamed the company's employees for the poor quality of service on the new subway line. As someone who had used the subway four times since its opening, this aforementioned writer noted not seeing, quote, a single instance where the company guards had, quote, interfered in the slightest with smokers or given any heed to them, end quote. The Interborough offered scant justice to these anti-smoking riders. It seemed to some observers, at least, that company interests appeared to supersede the public health concerns of non-smokers. And IRC priorities, evidently, according to writers, did not include the air quality found on the trains and station platforms. So for non-smoking customers, the physical conditions of the subway and the Interborough's supposed inability to curtail smoking raised questions about company behavior and, as I argue in the paper, thus class power. For non-smoking riders, the prevalence of smoking, despite rules that forbade this practice, led many to conclude that the company was guilty of neglect. And this next core section of the paper looks at subway workers and what I call the limits of enforcement. In the generally confined spaces of subway cars and subway stations, why should it have been so difficult for the Interborough to curtail smoking among so many of their customers? The general failure of the IRT to banish smoking from the subways and station platforms resulted, as I argued, from the work experiences, the working conditions, and class location of workers on the lines, especially conductors and ticket sellers, but also guards on the subway. Subway workers labored at the nexus of two competing class systems that weighed heavily on them. And this is probably reminiscent of the Susan Porter Benson essay on customers, thank God, in 1981. First, they were employees of the IRT and thus fully expected to enforce its rules, including no smoking rules. Second, and perhaps more important, they were the focal point of interaction between customers and inter-borough policies. Due to widespread smoker resistance, as well as worker ambivalence toward IRT policies and customer angst, smoking bans on the subways became almost ineffectual. Several articles and letters from the Times illustrated how the prevalence of smoking on the trains created many problems for subway workers. As observers suggested, smoking was so widespread that it would have been almost impossible to stop every rider from lighting a cigar or cigarette. In 1909, a writer who called himself or herself Fair Play wrote to the Times, quote, "A certain percentage of men are bound to smoke and will smoke, despite all ordinances and placards to the contrary." When observers looked around the train stations like Fair Play, they saw smokers everywhere, young and old alike. Quote, "Not only do many men continue to puff their cigars on the platforms, but cigarettes are lighted freely by youngsters waiting for trains," end quote. So smoking by boys in particular is thought to be egregiously offensive to riders. Non-smokers criticized subway workers for their powerlessness to stop smoking, as well as their apparent complicity. For example, in a 1909 letter to the Times, Edwin C. Walker, on one hand, he cheered a recent Board of Health announcement that the city was going to finally do something about this smoking problem on the subway. But he used that occasion to lash out against the failings of subway staffers. He condemned cigarettes first as, quote, "light abuse," and noted that, quote, "nuisance has prevailed ever since the subway was opened," end quote. Walker, though, blamed subway workers for shirking their duty as employees of the company, and thereby neglecting on smokers' health. He said, quote, "Did any passenger ever see an employee making the slightest attempt to enforce it, that being no smoking rules? Ask a platform man to stop open violation of the rule, and 9 times out of 10, he is either unable to see smoking, being careful only to look between puffs, or you are snubbed or abused for calling attention to his duty," end quote. Progressives would be frustrated. Walker suggests he had a history of encounters with subway workers and resented the outcomes of these interactions. He went on to call attention to an even deeper hypocrisy, though, among workers, that being smoking on the job. Walker wrote, quote, "Worse than this, from the point of view of example and discipline, at the terminal and relay stations, many of the employees of the company in uniform or out of it smoke whenever they choose, and with no attempt to avoid the attention of any higher employees who may be present," end quote. Once again, he seems to fume as a result of earlier encounters with subway workers. He goes on to say, quote, "I have even known a ticket seller to smoke into the faces of buyers of tickets." I think he meant himself. "They've seen taking the number of a delinquent. You are fortunate if you are not threatened with physical violence and bodily abuse," end quote. These angry voices of subway workers on the job surely stemmed from their many negative experiences with customers. As suggested by press reports, subway workers who tried to enforce no smoking rules were often confronted by hostile customers. In particular, dealings with upper class passengers were especially frustrating. In December 1906, the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company abolished its popular smoker car service for riders. Within days, the ban went into effect, and subway staffers would now have to enforce a rule that few riders knew about. On the first day, according to Times, a, quote, "fat, jovial chap," end quote, walked onto the subway platform with his lit cigar, and an alert station manager chased after him. The Times highlighted the men's different class backgrounds by drawing attention to their accents. In this context, the less articulate train worker had to convince the gentleman to comply in exchange with this, quote, "Hey, you," he yelled at, darting after the fat man, quote, "you'll have to chuck away that butt, it's against the rules," end quote. The fat man turned in surprise. "What's that?" he asked sharply. "I say, you'll have to throw away that cigar. Smoking ain't allowed no more," end quote. "Who says so?" "I say so." "Are you the president of the road?" sarcastically. "No, I ain't their president, but them's his orders," end quote. The hefty man, though, waved the worker away and boarded the train with a cigar, despite protests. On the train, he was confronted again, this time by a guard. The guard stops this rider smoker and told him there were no longer any smoking cars in service. And after yet another debate over company policies, the now, quote, "mystified and disgusted man," end quote, finally tossed away his sniper, end quote, sniper cigar. That same day, a subway worker asked an affluent woman, designated by her gray gown that she wore on the train, to put out her cigarette as she boarded the train, only to be verbally castigated for not addressing her with the proper deference. So for subway workers to fulfill their work obligations, they had to confront other formidable arrangements of social class from the world above ground. Wealthy upper-class riders readily challenged lowly subway workers' tenuous claims to authority and command. In the subway workers' exchanges with the, quote, fat jovial chap, end quote, and the wealthy lady in her gray gown, we see skewed or almost ironic class arrangements. Underground subway workers trying to urge these wealthy and powerful, presumably wealthy and powerful individuals from the world above ground to comply with their need for cooperation. And throughout these articles, you see patrician New Yorkers resisting conforming to these unfamiliar, almost reversed social roles. I was surprised to discover that non-smokers offered only infrequent observations and complaints about smoking riders of obvious working class backgrounds. There was one occasion where a New York Times letter exposed this biased middle class perspective of working class men, though, as this angry writer lodged a complaint about, quote, ill-bred men who carry their extinguished cigars while they rode the subway, ruining the air with what this person called nauseating stink.
About 1 more minute.
About 1 minute, so you're going to jump ahead. So then there's the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of March 1911, where 146 working class women of New York's Lower East Side are killed in this fire. And this greatly undermines any hope for legitimacy of public smoking in progressive area New York. And the result is the New York Times is reporting escalating arrests for smoking in public spaces. So, for example, in 1911, throughout the whole year, there are only 127 arrests and citations made for smoking cigarettes on trains and subways. That now, for January and February of 1912 alone, that number has jumped to 226 of arrests for smoking on the trains. Now, in response, smoker resistance, ironically, is intensifying. And you see reports in the press of individual smokers who, quote, press their rights to smoke. In the worst cases, non-smokers complained about smokers blowing smoke in their faces on trains as they're confronted with their glares. And resistance is also assuming broader collective dimensions post-trial. By 1913-1914, there are reports in the New York Times of tobacco stores that say smokers assert their rights, or assert your rights, in the windows of the cigar stores. And there was in one case a petition sent to the city where 70,000 people were writing to ask for the ban on smoking cars to be lifted. So this riot that resulted in August 1913, when William Windermere is arrested, I think it exposed a lot of these underground conflicts in New York subway culture. We have subway workers bristling against upper-class customers, smokers trying to resist this company policy, and non-smokers who are frustrated to no end about smokers' non-compliance with company authority. So all of these commingling class relations and conflicts, I argue, were exposed by this August 1913 street fight. And thank you for having me.
Thanks very much. Our next speaker is going to be John Lloyd. The title is, I'm going to say a word by John, first of all, in case you don't know him. He's an assistant professor of history at Cal Poly in Pomona, California, where in 1993 he's taught courses on the Jacksonian era, Civil War, Reconstruction, Gilded Age and Progressive Era, Depression and New Deal, Labor History, American Constitutional History, and Research Methods. Received his PhD at the Claremont Graduate University, where his doctoral dissertation explored the growth of ideas about race, civil rights, and equal citizenship after the Civil War. Currently worked on a manuscript based on that dissertation, and has also published numerous articles and book reviews, most recently a study of the Great Strikes of 1877, published in the Journal of Illinois History in 2007, and an essay on progressive era writer Herbert Croly in an anthology on Croly, published by Cambridge University Press in 2009. Since 2009, he's been director of the Teaching American History Grant for teachers in Riverside, California Unified School District, and lectures to teachers groups throughout Southern California. He's also an active member of the faculty union, the California Faculty Association. And John's talk is entitled Crowds, Class, and Community, the Pittsburgh Mob and the Strike of 1877. All yours,
Thank you. I'm I just want to warn you, this is a work in progress, so I'm here to share and get feedback from you. I've long been interested in moments of historical contingency when social relations that had been relatively static are thrown open to question. And for this reason, the strikes of 1877 have interested me. It's a moment when the nation turns its attention from the issues of race during Reconstruction to issues of class as America's industrialization increases. And I happen to be with my teacher's group last summer in Philadelphia, and I was actually looking for something else at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, and serendipitously came across the Pennsylvania State Legislature's report on the strike in Pittsburgh, the railroad strike in Pittsburgh in 1877. My previous work had looked at the strike in Chicago. But in Pittsburgh, unlike other cities that erupted in 1877, the strikers and the mob, as they were almost universally referred to, burned down much of the city, specifically the rail yards in downtown Pittsburgh. And this is part of what led the Hayes administration to decide it had to send in federal troops. So it's an interesting strike from the standpoint that it's the only one where, you know, a major portion of the city is actually destroyed during the strike. And the legislature's report is quite revealing. So the questions I want to look at include what conditions in Pittsburgh gave rise to the great fire that destroyed the Pennsylvania Railroad Depot, and what do these actions suggest about the nature of the strike in Pittsburgh and nationwide? Most people in here probably know about the strike, but I think it's worth giving a quick overview. The strike takes place in the context of a nationwide depression in the 1870s, a recurring event that seems to go with unregulated capitalism. And some historians have suggested that wages fell an aggregate of 50% during the 1870s. It's a staggering figure, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't all come at once. Wage cuts come over time, but also you have to factor in people, the unsteadiness of work, that one might be unemployed for weeks at a time, or even months. There's sporadic striking in the 1870s as things go on. So there are hints of this. Railroad workers, however, were especially hard hit by the Depression, and there's a series of wage cuts in May of 1877. Railroad executives meet in Chicago and collude and decide that they're going to cut they're all going to cut their workers' wages by 10%. And Baltimore and Ohio President John Garrett famously said the reason we did this was, quote, upon the great principle upon which we are all joined was to earn more and spend less. It's one of the beauties of Gilded Age capitalists is that they are quite blunt about their aims. So in light of that, Pennsylvania Railroad President Tom Scott announces a 10% pay cut to begin June 1st of 1877. But more importantly, he announces that the trains that will be, the freight trains will be doubled in length. These were called double headers. So a normal train was 18 cars, a normal freight train was 18 cars. They're going to double the length of the train to 36 cars, add an extra engine for more pulling power, but the crew only goes up from 6 to 8 persons. So you've got 100% increase in workload if you're a crew member, and only a 30% increase in staffing. And railroad workers complained about this bitterly. And this, it seems to me, as much as the pay cut, was the source of much anger. So you've got an increase in workload and a cut in pay. And I might add, thinking about the effects of that, it's important to remember how dangerous railroad work was. So you increase a workload, you're going to have more injuries. And this is, of course, in the period before there's any kind of social safety net. So you're talking about a threat to people's livelihoods. Okay. So Baltimore and Ohio President Garrett followed close behind with an announcement that a 10% pay cut would take place on his railroad beginning on June 16th. On July 16th, the strike breaks out in Martinsburg, West Virginia, probably not too far from your neck of the woods, and quickly spreads up to New York, to Baltimore, and then within days spreads to Pittsburgh. It would later spread to Chicago, St. Louis, and even out into San Francisco. It's the first nationwide strike, really, for all intents and purposes, a general strike. Strike begins in Pittsburgh on Thursday, July 19th, and the it's a spontaneous strike. The freight workers in the downtown freight center, there's Pittsburgh. I found this wonderful map of Carnegie Library, and here's the freight yards here. They stretch from here all the way through this central downtown area along the Allegheny River. And this round structure here, which is, I know it's probably pretty difficult for you to see, but there's a round structure. That is the famous roundhouse. The main line then goes out this way. And up here, just out of the picture, is one of the stations called the Torrens Station. The main points of strike activity would be right here at 28th Street, here at the Roundhouse, and then out at Torrens Station. In the early hours of the morning, freight crews in the rail yard refused to move outgoing trains. By mid-morning, the crowd had begun to grow. It estimates somewhere between 40 and 50 people in the freight yard, strikers, all railroad workers, and refusing to move any trains. There was no violence at this point. The only violence reported was a rock-throwing incident when one crew tried to move a freight train out and strikers threw rocks at them and they ran off. Okay, but there's relatively little violence at this point. Early in the morning, a Pennsylvania Railroad official goes to City Hall and asks the mayor for 10 police officers to accompany him to the rail yard to protect the crews. The mayor reluctantly agrees, and I think the mayor's response, the response of city authorities in general, was intriguing to me and suggested that this was more than a railroad strike. This was a strike that involved the whole community. The mayor of Pittsburgh at the time was a man named William Roaring Bill McCarthy. He came from a working class background, and his previous political experience during Reconstruction was to lead a group that was critical of President Andrew Johnson's visit to Pittsburgh during the election of 1866. And that's actually what I was in Philadelphia looking for last summer. I was researching the Reconstruction period. And it turns out that McCarthy McCarthy was a staunch proponent of the radical Republicans in Congress at the time, many of whom, like Thaddeus Stevens, were also generally pro-labor in their view. And so McCarthy's this interesting working class Republican character. And I looked for a picture of him. I have not yet been able to find one, but there's not a lot of information. After 1877, he sort of falls off the radar screen. In the official Pittsburgh histories where they list everybody who's been married, he's listed, but he doesn't get the usual biography. And I think partly because he's blamed for his role in not stopping the strike sooner. Okay, so McCarthy finally says, all right, I'll grant you your 10 police officers, but you have to pay for it. And so the railroad officials and the 10 privately paid officers go down to the train station here at 28th Street, and they confront the strikers who are guarding the switch and won't let any trains out. And there's a brief altercation during which time one of the strikers basically slugs the railroad official in the face and runs off, and the police chase after him, and he wasn't caught. One wonders how vigorously they chased after him. That's never concluded. Okay. The railroad superintendent goes back to the mayor, asks this time for 100 men because the crowd is starting to grow. The mayor responded that he didn't have 100 men, and subsequent committee and the legislative committee concluded that McCarthy failed to send, is to blame because he failed to send more men at this hour when the strike might have been broken by the police officers. But McCarthy seems to be a scapegoat here. First, he didn't have that many men on duty because the city had cut during the Depression, they had cut the police budget. And second, it seems to me that McCarthy's passive-aggressive posture here, rather than being incompetent, as the legislative committee concluded, was actually a tacit expression of sympathy with the strikers, and a poke in the eye at the company, as it was called, Pennsylvania Railroad, whose imperious officials were resented by many in the town. There's strong evidence to suggest that this sympathy was shared by a wide spectrum of the mayor's constituents. Later that evening, when company officials rounded up the sheriff, the sheriff was unable to find sufficient volunteers to go, oust the strikers from the freight yard. Many of the men making up excuses for why they could not join the posse to round up strike leaders. When company officials got a judge to issue warrants for the strike's ringleaders, the legislators' report concluded the police made no serious attempt to find or arrest the accused. Oh boy, okay. So by the evening of the 19th, finally there has the crowd has increased. The sheriff goes to try to break it up. And here's where it gets really interesting. By this time, the working class communities in the neighborhoods surrounding have converged on the rail yard. And the report says there are children there, there are women, and notes particularly that the women were vociferous in shouting down the sheriff when he finally does go and tells them to disperse. Early in the morning of Friday the 20th, the Pittsburgh militias finally brought in. And this has been widely known for years that the Pittsburgh militia basically fraternizes with the strikers. But so the next day, long story short, the Philadelphia militia from across the state is brought in. And they confront the strikers here at the 28th Street crossing and open fire. And 22 are killed instantly, an untold number are wounded, many carried off, and that's when all hell breaks loose. So it's the bringing in of state authority that sparks the violence. And what I found fascinating is when, first of all, the crowd goes into the neighborhoods, arms themselves, and then comes back. And eventually, at nightfall, chases the Philadelphia militia into the roundhouse and keeps them under siege all night. Meanwhile, community members converge on the rail yards. They loot all of the rail cars. And the legislature reports that women are prominent among the looters. The fire chief testifies that he could not identify any by name, but that they looked Irish. I love that. They looked Irish. He testifies also that the crowd, which is now made up of more people who are non-railroad employees than railroad employees, won't let, they set fire to the rail yard. And I'm finishing up.
Okay.
My last point here is one of the things I found particularly interesting is that when the fire department's called up, they won't let the fire department put a drop of water on any Pennsylvania Railroad property. But the nearby properties, fine. So, you know, this fire is often presented as this, just this general conflagration, but it's actually very focused on just Pennsylvania Railroad property. So my argument here is twofold. One, that this was not just a strike by railroad workers. This was a community action that stemmed from long simmering anger at this company that dominated the town. And secondly, it was very focused. It was focused on the Pennsylvania Railroad and its property, and not, you know, any capitalist or any businessman. So those are my two central insights, and there's much more, but I'm gonna cut it short.
Thank you very much.
Very easy.
Our next speaker is going to be Peter McInnes, who is an associate professor of history at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, and he teaches courses on labor and working class history in the 60s and development studies. Recently become president of the faculty union. It's a job, as he says, to keep all the membership happy all the time. Good luck with that. You want to see him walk on water when you think about that? All right. The title of his talk is An Incident at Resource Siding, Bushworkers and the Historical Memory of Violent Confrontation. And I'll let you go into about 15 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. I said, on the map there, we're in the River Lawrence area. I'm talking about the volley of gunfire came without warning. At 12:30, 400 unarmed Union loggers were engaged in a short but intense shootout with 20 independent pulp cutters known as settlers. The striking loggers were in the midst of an illegal wildcat action and had traveled south a distance along Highway 11 from the remote northern Ontario town of Kapuskasing to the premises of a Balmeda lumber cooperative at Reeser Siding, a small hamlet 37 miles west. Once there, they had intended to scatter nearly 600 cords of pulpwood cut by the settlers and stacked along the line of the Canadian National Railway for transport to the nearby mill. The carnage of 11 February 1963 shocked the nation. The Toronto Telegram observed that the single barrage nearly tore the head off one victim. The second man died instantly, quote, his body riddled like a sieve, and the third succumbed to multiple wounds minutes later. Pronounced dead were Joseph Fortier, 32, his brother Henri, 25, and Fernand Durand, age 29. Eight Union men were treated at the Kapuskasing Hospital and later released. No settlers were injured. Police seized a quantity of arms, including 10 rifles, 2 shotguns, and a revolver. Tipped off regarding the potential raid down the Wood Valley, the Ontario Provincial Police were on scene at the time of the shootout, but claimed their 12-member squad was ineffective in controlling the sheer numbers of men. Several of the officers themselves had nearly escaped gunfire. Staff Inspector Ralph Taylor stated that the attack was so unexpected that two of our officers had bullets pass through their clothes. One of the men killed was standing directly in front of an officer, Noted Taylor, another man was shot standing beside him. OPP constables had been ordered not to use their weapons. Immediately following the shootout, police escorted settlers to safety through an angry cordon of union members. Following the shooting, trade unions quickly denounced this act of woodland justice. Donald McDonald, Secretary Treasurer of the Canadian Labor Congress, remarked, "It seems incredible at this juncture in our history that these three men could be killed and others wounded in the course of a dispute. No sadder commentary to be made on this archaic level of industrial relations." The 33-day strike by two locals of the Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union totaled 1,500 bush workers, and it began when Kimberly Clark refused to accept the collective agreement signed by the union with Abitibi Power as part of a pattern bargaining. It was further complicated by the fact that most of the newsprint was purchased to American markets, and in New York City, Local 6, or Big 6, of the International Typographer Union was on a citywide strike in December 1962, so the demand for newsprint had plummeted. Despite these uncertainties, plans for a strike carried forward. Strictly speaking, the action was legal, as law stated that strikes could only commence 7 days after a conciliation report had been filed and this had not occurred. The job action quickly became a bitter affair that sharply divided the surrounding communities. The issue was the timber had to be removed from the bush before the spring thaw broke it up. Any wood left to rot over the intervening months would be useless as a sellable commodity. The persistence into the 1960s of a truck system of leverage debt in northern Ontario communities was a reminder of precarious existence for all these bush workers. Each of these farmers, the unionized group, non-union group, relied on credit from late September to January when they started receiving income from their pulp cutting. Cubs casing mayor Norman Grant, a Spruce Falls employee of the mill, offered the alarmist claim that 1,000 settlers faced imminent starvation. "These settlers are getting so desperate," Grant claimed, "they're going into the bush with guns and will shoot anyone who tries to interfere with their cutting." Along the back roads, the tense game of cat and mouse played out as lumber and saw mobilized cavalcades of vehicles to intercept the farmers and dump their pulp in the ditch. As the company only paid for what delivered to the mill premises, the flying pickets remained a persistent antagonism. When the real violence erupted, it was not unexpected. In what was described as one of the biggest mass murder committals in Canadian history, 20 men were ordered held on trial for 60 non-capital charges. So at this point, capital offenses were still in the criminal code, but these were an adjustment, so they weren't going to be tried for a possible execution, but it was still a serious charge. The original docket for the lesser offense, shooting with intent to injure, met with an angry public response, so he escalated. Magistrate W.S. Gardner indicated that he would dismiss indictments against Palomino Palom, manager of the Valdivia Cooperative. By October, the seven-member grand jury of the Ontario Supreme Court came down with a ruling of no bills, that is, insufficient evidence. Joseph LaForce, the president of the local union, bitterly denounced the verdict. "It's illegal to kill a moose, but you can get away with killing three men." He pointed out that this type of violence would never be allowed in the southern centers, but in the north there was some type of condemnation, or they would condone, I should say, intra-class violence. Why do this in the woods? The union was also condemned to to account. 237 members of the raiding party were charged with unlawful assembly, and most of those charges were led to conviction. While some of the initial arrests were rescinded, most of the unions were convinced the charges were unfair. In the end, the wheels of justice had turned to no one's satisfaction. In a modern post-war regime of North American industrial relations, this sort of bloodshed was supposed to be redundant. Logic and due process were supposed to replace such crude tests of strength. Questions remain unanswered in light of this escalation. How did things go so wrong? In large measure, Kamloops-Nisku, Ontario owed its existence to a single newspaper, not just any publication, but the New York Times. It was the Times, in partnership with Kimberly Clark, about a 50-50 ownership, established the pulp mill in the early 1920s. Kemp's casing, therefore, conforms very closely to the description of a resource or company town, as defined by sociologists and geographers, in that it was a small, isolated community focused on a single resource industry. Community motto, "Town Out of the Forest," was an apt description for a resource extractive venture into this forest, had, for all intents and purposes, made the town. the arrival of the Spruce Falls Power and Paper Company supplied a needed injection of industrial investment. The company was granted a 99-year lease over 6,000 square miles of common land. The history of the union, Lumber and Saw Mill Workers Union, dates back from the early part of the 20th century, but it really got its impetus in the post-Second World War organization when it was joined as an adjunct to the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners. This was from the onset a very tempestuous relationship with the left-leaning bush workers existing as an awkward appendage to the ideologically conservative Carpenters Union. With the passage of the United States of the Taft-Hartley Act and the later Land on Griffin, the business lobbyists were pushing for similar legislation north of the border. In northern Ontario, Cold War purges removed the communist leadership in this union by 1951. However, the broadly sketched linkages of union activism with communist subterfuge continued well into the 1960s and effectively limited public acceptance for Lumber and Saw as it was once a, quote, red union. I call this section Union Thugs. By the early 1960s, public perceptions of organized labor in Canada and indeed North America were often associated with violent strikes and sordid internal politics and corruption of some unions. Testimony in Canada for the Norris Royal Commission on Great Lakes Shipping provided successive months of lurid details of the Seafarers International Union and its notorious boss, Halsey Banks. There was a commission that looked at corruption in the construction industry as well. In the United States, the widely publicized trial of Teamsters Chief Jimmy Hoffa for bribery and jury tampering led to fears of mob influenced unions. In this light, it was easy to conflate reports of labor troubles and denounce all unions as anti-social housecasts. To the casual observer, unions and violence were a logical equation. Bush workers were not immune from this taint. Ricky reports in February 1963, the shootings fit into this trope of violence. So you have a particular sense of violence that's going to happen in these areas. And earlier in the 1920s, two organizers, Finnish Canadian organizers, known as Leo Roosevelt and Yanni Puchalainen, were found murdered. Well, they disappeared. The official inquest found their bodies when they were found the next morning. And the next spring of 1930, their deaths were ruled accidental drowning. The verdict met with considerable skepticism then, as it did in the 1960s. Those who venture into the woods to stir up class-based agitation entered a liminal world where violence may erupt beyond the purview of civilization. Bush workers and lumberjacks have come under considerable historical scrutiny, and you get this image of the North Woods, tough guy persona of the lumberjacks, men engaged in dangerous and physically demanding occupation, must prove themselves. Sociologists like Chris Papp have described this as a worker performance, frequently pushed male laborers to take their chances of their own safety. In instances of these types of work, labor disputes, therefore, maybe bush workers may be expected to apply the same physical and emotional toughness. They were all, after all, inheritors of the lumberjack and mystique. By the early 1960s, these pulp cutters were no longer people that spent months in the woods and then came back into the town and embarked on a wild, drunken spree. Rather, they were family men. They commuted to work and returned each evening to their wives and children. Mortgages and car payments were foremost in their minds of these workers. So they were, in fact, the very model of temper, husbands and fathers. This emphasis on the family was also reported on the settlers. This is, again, a non-union group that attacked the unionists. The Chronicle Mail wrote admiringly of one settler, Marcel Millet, 37-year-old father of seven, who, like his father before him, quote, cut the homestead out of the bush. Millet is a settler, one of a breed of men who pioneered this northern bush country, first working as loggers and then with their income building homes and farms. Millet said, "We have to help each other. That's why so many of the settlers came out that night to research siding." So it's an interesting notion of individuality, and yet collectively, their collectivity is to protect the individuality, whereas the union's collectivity is more of engaged in mob violence. It's an interesting turn of this. So my conclusion is I talk a little bit about historical memory and violent confrontation. So the historical remembrances of this incident in resurciting in February 1963 led to the installation of a historical plaque put up by the province of Ontario. The plaque has a somewhat ahistoric take on the role of the state. It concludes, the tone says, the tragedy, quote, was prompted the provincial government to intervene and settle the strike by arbitration, so suggesting that the state solved the problem rather than caused the problem. The United Steelworkers, the successor union to Lumber and Saw, eventually built an impressive concrete monument located at the site of the shooting. So I just want to show you a couple of images to highlight what I'm talking about here. So, if you look at images of Paul Bunyan, you know, this is, of course, a folk art of the supersized lumberjack, and I think this one's in the city of Minnesota or Maine. There's a number of them around. So you can see it from the perspective of the people, it's larger than life. Here's another one, pretty much the same proportion of Paul Bunyan and the baby, the blue oxen. In Canadian mythology, you have, especially Quebecois and Franco-Ontarian, you have Jos Montferrand. And again, it's a very image of virile masculinity, supersized axe, and all this type of thing. There's another version based somewhat on Jos Montferrand. Did it come up? Okay, so Montferrand. This is in Montgolfier. This is a carved wood depiction. But if you look at the image of the monument at resurciting, so here's the historical plaque in the foreground, and you can see this monument. And rather than this type of depiction, it actually is quite different. You can see, rather than the supersized lumberjack, you have a depiction of a woodworker with his family flanked on two sides. So it's a much different message than this hyper-masculinity. It's a family man. And it's mixing these messages about providers. So they're both providers. And so the way that this violence was interpreted in the end was an unfortunate circumstance of, you know, individual contests of will, and sometimes this happens. And also, you know, given that the fact that this was in the woods, you know, it's almost like Jack Nicholson being told, in Chinatown, it's Chinatown, Jake, you know, these things happen. And I just would, finally, here's the historical plaque, I'm just going to bring that up. There's the computer on this one. Let me just try to bring this one up. Okay, no, I'll come back. Well, let me talk about this one. This is, if anybody remembers the Bugs Bunny cartoons from the 1950s, this is a French-Canadian logger known as Black Jack Chirac. And he speaks in pidgin English, and you know, he's a bit of a nefarious character. So you have this image of these people that are rowdy, they're prone to violence, and yet when violence actually does happen, it's interpreted in this particular way. And the slide I can't get to come up is the slide of the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado, which some of you may remember was defaced in 2003, the heads were knocked off. And there's always a question, whether that was a deliberate thing about, you know, representation of class and violence. And if you look at, I was searching for images of, you know, workers, the other fit that model of, you know, supermasculinity. But the one in the Ludlow, which I'm sure I can't get up now that I want to do it, there it is, shows again images of a family. So it's a different, and of course, there were families, wives, and children were killed in that massacre when they were attacked by Christians, I guess it was. And company thugs. So it's just interesting. I'm just kind of playing around with that issue. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, all right. So just to conclude, I would say, you know, things happen. There's instances of violence, but instead of saying that the legislation failed these people, the industrial relations regime in the post-war compromise was starting to come apart clearly in the early 1960s. We have some talk about unions being prone to violence, especially red unions being illegitimized. And yet, most of the coverage talks about, you know, well, they were mostly, the two men that killed were Quebecois from the province of Quebec, but most of that area is predominantly French-speaking, so it's Franco-Ontarian. It's almost like that's the way they resolve it. It's almost like West Virginia. And they're going to shoot each other, but, you know, we couldn't do it. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Linda Holder, who is a doctoral student at the University of Arizona. She's currently working on a dissertation provisionally entitled Employers Unite, Organized Employer Responses to the Rise of Labor Unions in the United States, 1900 to 1917, which examines and compares the membership as well as the political and public relations strategies of the National Association of Manufacturers and the National Civic Federation. The title of a paper today is The Payoffs of Class Privilege, the National Association of Manufacturers versus Labor in Congress, 1902 to 1914.
Thank you. So basically, what my paper is about the discrepancy of power that workers versus employers exercise over politics in the United States, or have historically exercised over politics in the United States. And I'm using a particular case to explore this issue. That case is the fate of anti-injunction legislation in Congress in the early 20th century. So beginning in the 1890s, the American Federation of Labor lobbied hard to get Congress to enact a law that would limit the use of court injunctions in labor disputes. Now, at first, the AFL efforts seemed to be going rather well. It helped write bills that friendly congressmen then introduced to it at the House, and it appeared to also be making headway in getting at least the House members on its side. But the AFL's efforts to get anti-injunction legislation passed was opposed by the National Association of Manufacturers, which was the most prominent and certainly the most vocal anti-union employer organization of the early 20th century. Now, the NAM held the advantage over the AFL in politics on a number of fronts. They had more money, they had better contacts, and somewhat less tangibly, they also benefited from certain well-established public perceptions regarding workers and other non-elites. Namely, workers are violent, they are robbery, they must be controlled, as you just showed. Now, most of the NAM strategy focused on acquiring influence with the congressional committees that discussed these particular labor bills. In the case of the anti-injunction bill, the House Judiciary Committee was the most important one, and as we'll see, the NAM trained its sight on gaining as much control over that committee as possible. Now, before we get into the specifics of the story, let me just really quickly run through some of the basics regarding court injunctions as they were used in the early 20th century. So what is an injunction? Well, an injunction is an order issued by a court, and it's meant to prevent what's called irreparable harm from happening. So the court orders a person or a group of people to stop doing certain actions, not necessarily in themselves illegal, but that might cause irreparable harm if they continue to do them in that particular context. And the way it was used in labor disputes was basically that the employer, who was a target of strike or other union action, would go to a judge and say, well, these workers are doing irreparable harm to my property, therefore please order them to stop. And the key point here is how courts constructed property. They didn't have to, the workers didn't actually have to damage anything, but the courts constructed property in a way that assumed that the employer actually had a property right in the maintenance of his business or in the flow of labor to his company, yes. So basically anything that the union does could be enjoined. So it's no wonder that the AFL wants to limit the use of these injunctions. And in fact, it made injunction reform one of its greatest priorities. But as I said, the National Association of Manufacturers mounts a counter-campaign to the AFL efforts. So now let's turn to the advantages that the NAM had in this process. Well, advantage number one, money. From the existing figures, it appears that in the decade between 1902 and 1912, the NAM spent anywhere from between $20,000 and $60,000 a year on lobbying and electoral campaigns. Now, to put that in context, depending on the year, that was at least double and sometimes as much as six times the amount that the AFL could spend on these same projects, lobbying and elections. So twice to six times what the AFL could muster. But the difference, though, isn't so much in the official figures as it is in the potential clout of manufacturers if the NAM managed to mobilize them for a particular campaign, for a political campaign, for instance. So most of the time, the NAM didn't even want campaign contributions to go through its official books because that could put it could make fun of Powell of campaign finance laws. So in the case of the House Judiciary Committee, for instance, which was the committee that handled these various anti-injunction bills, the NAM got involved in the electoral campaigns of at least two committee members. The committee chairman, John Jenkins, and an important committee member, Charles Littlefield. In both of these cases, the NAM sent its chief political operative to help in the campaigns of these congressmen and then paid the salary and expenses of that operative, so this is direct support for the candidates. And at the same time, the officers of the NAM tried to raise funds directly for the campaigns. Now, how much exactly they managed to raise is somewhat unclear since it's been necessarily made documentation. But in the Littlefield campaign, for instance, estimates of what they spent went as high as $40,000. So if you think that, if you note that the NAM spent maybe $60,000 a year officially, and then if they spend $40,000 in a single electoral campaign, so that gives some perspective on how much they could raise funds if they put their minds to it. The NAM itself viewed such spending and fundraising as explicit tools to show Congress that the manufacturers were more powerful than the unions. The AFL had targeted both Littlefield and Jenkins, the guys that the NAM supports in these campaigns. The AFL had targeted them for defeat because of their lack of sympathy for Labor's legislative goals. But the NAM argued that if the AFL succeeded in defeating these men, then the AFL could claim victory. And that, in turn, as the NAM secretary said, would mean that other members of Congress might be intimidated from taking the stand on our behalf. So congressmen might think that employers are more important in politics that workers are more important in politics than employers, and that would not do. So the NAM was also quite clear that it expected financial help to campaigns to translate into concrete influence. So, for example, the NAM calculated that if it could help Jenkins retain his congressional seat, and I quote, "it will place us in such a position at the next session of Congress that we will have but very little to do to defeat any obnoxious legislation." In other words, Jenkins would be grateful and would need very little further planning to comply with the NAM's wishes that the anti-injunction bills should be buried in committees and not be brought to a vote in the House. So that's money. Well, money surely mattered, but it did not quite undo the advantage of numbers that workers had on election day. And this was brought home to the NAM repeatedly, including in the anti-injunction fight. For example, in 1908, the Judiciary Committee Chairman John Jenkins, whom the NAM had supported, lost the Republican primary despite NAM and other manufacturers' support, largely because he was perceived as someone who opposed all social and labor legislation. So in addition to throwing money at campaigns, the NAM tried its best to use contacts, not only in electioneering, but also in maintaining relations with whoever sat in Congress. A particularly effective way was to try and build contacts with the members of important committees and with people who otherwise held key positions in Congress. Of course, this was greatly facilitated by the NAM's willingness to also fund congressional campaigns. But even more importantly, the NAM was also able to appeal to congressmen through shared acquaintances, common institutions, and a common class background. Now, the NAM's contacts with the House Judiciary Committee rather neatly illustrate the various avenues that the NAM could try to use to counteract the workers' advantage of numbers. Of course, the NAM used standard lobbying techniques like writing letters and so forth, but at least as important as such techniques was a more personal level of connectedness. So first and most powerful was a personal friendship of an NAM member or a close NAM ally with a particular member of Congress. The NAM regularly tried to find out if it had anyone among its members who knew a particular key congressman. As the association secretary put it, "indeed, it is one of the fine things about our association that a great many of our good friends everywhere, when we can only find out the truth, are very close to many public men." In the House Judiciary Committee, the NAM did have a few such avenues. For example, take John Jenkins, again, the chairman of the committee until 1909. He was a personal acquaintance of a prominent Minnesota anti-union businessman whom the NAM then asked to keep in touch with him. While another businessman in Wisconsin repeatedly had conversations with Jenkins in order to make sure that he understood the NAM's wishes. Second, the NAM also used the channels available through party politics. Many of the NAM's members were, in fact, important people in the Republican Party hierarchy. Almost all NAM members who are non-Southern were Republicans, and a substantial number of these were closely involved in party affairs. The association secretary also had been the private secretary of Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, while his main political worker, the guy that it sent to run these campaigns, had a decades-long experience in the Republican Party. And in the early 20th century, the NAM also benefited greatly from a close alliance with House Speaker Joseph Cannon, the famous sandpad Republican who opposed all labor legislation. Now, both of these strategies, using personal friendships and drawing on party hierarchies, were premised in part on class affiliation of the NAM, on the class affiliation of the NAM's members. Although they like to represent themselves as up by one's bootstraps by kind of guys, a large portion of the politically active NAM members actually were came from fairly wealthy backgrounds, and they tended to have high school or college educations. They tend to be the sons of businessmen, and generally to be men of at least local prominence, thus allowing them to talk to congressmen, who usually were lawyers, more or less on a plane of equality. In their letters to congressmen, manufacturers also sometimes emphasized class explicitly. One letter, for instance, noted that standing up against the bills the AFL promoted in Congress, the congressman would earn the gratitude and good wishes not only of your own constituents, but of the best elements in the country. Okay, so both in money and in influence, the NAM had the advantage over the AFL. But again, this was not necessarily an overwhelming advantage, and the NAM certainly perceived a need to keep working in order to hold the advantage. In addition to their potential voting power, workers could also potentially raise funds. A little from many can end up a lot, after all. And workers also had some reformer allies and other influential friends who might do like the NAM did and put pressure on congressmen in a more personal way. But here we come to the more subtle, but in some ways also the most powerful, advantage the NAM held over workers, public perception of workers. Now, in some ways, one would not expect public opinion to find the NAM's message very appealing. The NAM officials certainly were no diplomats, and they rarely managed to sound anything like reasonable. And in the progressive era, of course, there's a lot of support for social legislation and also a lot of suspicion of business. But in some ways, the very stridency of the NAM drew the balance of discussion to their corner. Because the NAM adopted such an utterly irreconcilable attitude toward unions, that any concession to unions from other employers or from other reformers would look like a meaningful compromise, given that the NAM refuses to compromise at all. This was particularly important on the injunction issue. Getting rid of injunctions, after all, would have substantially increased unions' independent room for maneuver, and a lot of reformers who might contemplate protective labor legislation were far more ambivalent about actually giving workers more power. The NAM made full use of the unease about workers' demands and workers' behavior in its battle against injunction reform. It called injunction reform a program to allow free conspiracy and free riot, and an effort to throw to the winds the sacred protection of the courts and to legalize mob rule. It reprinted court opinions that condemned union practices like picketing and boycotting as unfair and immoral. In all its publicity, it did what it could to promote a view of unionized workers as fanatical, ridiculous, and/or violent. In fact, the injunction itself was useful not only for practical reasons, but also as a publicity tool, because an injunction could turn what might have been a peaceful and even dignified scene of picketing into a scene of mass arrests. To be sure, to conclude, now certainly the American Federation of Labor did not play all its political cards in the most effective way possible, nor were its policies regarding which allies to cultivate and what issues to emphasize necessarily always commendable or wise. And so certainly we need to recognize the problems within the labor movement itself. But we also need to keep researching and emphasizing the ways in which money, contact, and perceptions, in effect the whole constellation of social class, created and continue to create a highly unequal distribution of political power in American society.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions? We have minutes left. Four questions. Does anybody have? So yes, we'll go back first.
Question primarily for John Lloyd. Why do you suppose the 1877 strike isn't as well known as it might be? I can think of examples. Sandy and Cole's wonderful American working class literature has all this stuff on Homestead and not one word on the 1877 strike, which was much more important, being the biggest national strike America has ever had for most reasons.
That's a good question. One that I don't have a good answer for. I think it's an underappreciated moment in American history. It tends to fall in most treatments of American history in this gap between, you know, the end of the Civil War Reconstruction period, beginning of industrialization. It's often seen as the opening shot in, you know, kind of a 60-year struggle in most narratives of labor history that culminates in the passage of the Wagner Act and formation of the CIO and industrial unionism in the 1930s. But I think there's, as I look at it, there's a lot more going on in there. I think certainly in the case of Pittsburgh, there's this gender question is really hasn't been studied at all, and yet it seems to me that women play a much more important role in this uprising, if you will, than has previously been appreciated. You know, one of the things that I skimmed over in my paper, witnesses tell the legislature that during the siege of the Roundhouse, women were bringing tea to the strikers, you know, and yet the legislature, in its multi, you know, they interviewed people for weeks, did interview one woman. So that, you know, even those at the time who wanted to find out what was going on, sort of silenced women's voices. And so it's one of the frustrations of historians that you have to kind of.
Yes, but
with hints.
I have a question for Billia. So it's really interesting. I'm dying to move it forward to 1932 when Norris LaGuardia passes. Why? Because it seems the AFL probably had more political power influence in the time you're thinking about. They're certainly on the ascendancy in terms of numbers, which they totally lost by 1932. Or they've lost a whole lot of them. And then they also don't have the progressive allies who have been beaten back over the period of the 20s. And the 1932 election hasn't happened, which brought, you know, a whole bunch of reform people into Congress. So how does NAM blow it? Or conversely, how does the later progressive, with LaGuardia and Norris, both
being
sort of old progressives, how did they finally get that through? Or did what they get through
bear
no resemblance to what
the AFL was supposed to do? Well, in fact, it did not. It did not. It's a very different kind of strategy that they tried, that actually passes in the Norris LaGuardia. I don't go that far in my research, but I think the guy who's done the most work on that would be William Wolf Horvath, whose work I'm relying on for all the basics of injunction. What he argues is that in the 1920s, there's a crazy explosion of the use of injunctions in the 1920s. And those scenes get so violent so often that it gets more attention. And it becomes one of these issues that the remaining progressives in the 1920s really focus on, that this is just beyond the pale. And so what he argues is that a new generation of progressives that then become the New Dealers are coming into prominence in the late 1920s. And these people, the AFL had wanted to exempt labor from consideration and to declare that labor is not a commodity. But the general view was by the 1920s that would never pass muster with the Supreme Court. And so what they do instead is they hedge around they put a lot of constraints on what particular situations can you issue injunctions. And that's what ends up passing. And I guess part of that too is that, well, even though the 1932 election hasn't happened, 1929 to 1932 certainly reduces business's credibility, right? So I think that's what he argues. I just believe
him. Yeah, okay.
Yes, please. Well, let me take you back to 1877 for a minute. I guess that often when I've talked about it in classes, I've always pointed out that it's the 100th anniversary of the American Revolution, and perhaps it's the second American Revolution. One piece of literature that I've put you onto, if you haven't seen already, I've argued elsewhere that there's kind of a continuation of what David Groom said is called the antebellum kind of labor practice. And part of that is community arbitration. And in a way, what you're describing is community arbitration. And it's the community is standing on the side versus, right? And that chances are very good that it very well may not have only been working class people, it very well may have been small shop owners and others who were of the community who were in effect on that side. The other piece of literature that my favorite thing on 1877, Marianne DeBussy's work on self-organization during St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Her argument is that one thing that we look at is the amount of people involved in the 1877 strikes who are themselves ex-soldiers. Mm-hmm. So these rifles were coming out for good reason, because they'd already used them on the side in the Civil War, which gave them a feeling of agency, which is very different. You know, and a lot of them being Irish who had fought in the Civil War from a variety of the northern cities.
That's certainly true in Chicago. I didn't find any direct references to Civil War veterans in Pittsburgh, although I'm sure there were veterans among the strikers and the members of the community. Another interesting book by David Sowell looks at Buffalo, the strike in Buffalo. And his argument is, which I think applies in Pittsburgh, he says railroads in the 19th century were impinging on working class communities and undoubtedly on merchants as well. But just think in terms of land use, where that railroad depot is situated and how the railroads are able to use eminent domain to expand into the surrounding communities. And of course, there's no buffer zone. These working class communities abutted these big freight yards, and with all the dust and the noise and the the activity there, they weren't popular. And one of the things that happens when the Pennsylvania Railroad completes the line from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh in the early 1850s, relegates Pittsburgh, which had a kind of privileged position in terms of east-west commerce. It relegates Pittsburgh to kind of almost—I don't want to say backwater status—but they certainly felt that they had been downgraded, and they were, the headquarters of companies in Philadelphia, and everybody felt like Philadelphians looked down their nose at Pittsburghers. And then the companies able to manipulate freight rates, so merchants in Pittsburgh were pissed off. So there are also reports of merchants, the strikers were saying at the time, the merchants support us. Later, when the legislature's committee calls these merchants on the carpet. They say, oh, we never said that. But at the time, there are a lot of references during the strike, overheard, workers overheard saying, yeah, the merchants are supporting us, and so undoubtedly that this was a community arbitration.
Other questions?
Well, I was just going to comment. I love that map that you used, the San Bernardino, I presume it was the San Bernardino or whatever, showing the geography. I mean, anybody who's been to Pittsburgh knows how hilly and like there are villages within. So once the community went in there and said, no, we're going to target this particular, you know, nobody can get in there, they could have locked up. And the other thing I was thinking is, a lot of those rail depots and train stations were at grade crossing, and they were very dangerous,
yeah.
And people would be walking in the neighborhood and get off by a train, so there was a lot of resentment.
Yeah.
I have a question, though, and maybe either in Pittsburgh or any place, are there any, the kind of things Peter talked about, visual or commemorations, either historical markers or statues to any of these people involved in any of the 1877, I was saying to John, I used to live in Hoboken, and there is a statue to Thomas Scott there, and it took all of my self-control not to do what happened to the statue, you know, Ludlow, to Thomas Scott, because it says, like, President, Pennsylvania Railroad, not son of a bitch.
Yeah.
So, but is there any commemoration of any place?
Well, that's...
there's a plaque on the top.
There is a plaque. Historical Society of Pennsylvania has a statewide program of historical markers,
yeah.
And there is one in Pittsburgh. And those of you who attended last year's conference in Pittsburgh, there was a wonderful session by a group of students who've actually done their own home, as a project, they did their own homemade markers that they designed to look like the official markers. But they painted them on aluminum instead of the heavy duty signs. But they put them all over the city at these spots where the strike took place, and they used it was like an alternative reading of the strike, where the official plaque is very bland and of course designed not to offend or inform anyone. These unofficial plaques were put up and. Sort of gave Labor's side of the story, and I thought it was a wonderful example of community arbitration today, right? Students taking history in their own hands and presenting it to their community. But officially, there is one plaque that's very bland. I don't remember the wording of it, but it's.
The only other the real visual is, of course, all the armories. And the big Richardsonian Armory in Pittsburgh is built after that.
Yeah,
in many of these cities.
Yeah, it's the strikes that give rise to these armories, and the strengthening and centralizing of control of the militias, and it wouldn't happen again.
The question in the back.
Right, I just want to thank everybody for your excellent presentation. My question is again to you. When you were giving the quick overview, you said the reconstruction was on red and then it shifted to plus in 1877.
My point. Go ahead and finish
the question. Yeah. I was wondering, so this class consciousness, class oriented movement, is just locally, was there any European immigration at that time, or was that fueled by that? And another is that, what happened to race?
Okay, well, those are both really good questions. I oversimplified it in my opening remarks, because I've been in the interest of time. But one of the interesting things that happens is that this strike occurs at the very moment when the Republican Party has agreed to remove federal troops from the South who've been there ostensibly to enforce the newly won citizenship rights of African Americans. So at the moment that, at the moment those troops are being moved out of the South, this conflagration breaks out, and those troops are now used in northern cities to put down the rebellions of workers. And so it seems to me a very significant shift in the intentions of the federal government. And the Hayes administration actually uses Civil War era justifications for putting, it labels these as domestic insurrections, and that give the federal government constitutional authority to use federal power. And that's ultimately what breaks these strikes, is the use of federal troops in these cities. And so I think it's, you know, one of the interesting historical what-ifs is, what if this strike happens before the Civil War, before the federal government had this power and this massive armed force to be able to be used? It could have led to a quite different outcome. We'll never know, but it's an interesting thing to think about, how the way in which the Civil War kind of impacts
this. Or to make a counter, what if it was to happen in 1873, rather, while the troops were still tied up in the South?
Yeah.
That, I mean, that even just move it just
right.
4 years.
Right.
And then you've got an interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, one more question. I was really intrigued in Peter's talk about the notion of the company town being a cross-border notion. Usually we really think of company town as having a situated, you know, big capitalist and the, you know, and that's the sort of the center of it, a plant that produces work there, the ownership's there. But you have the Kimberly-Clark Paper Company, the New York Times, all in, you know, the centers of power in this whole town. Yet the conflict, does the conflict invoke them at all? Did they ever become, part of
the... I haven't seen that much, and it's a good point. The company was referred to as the Big Spruce because it was part of the power. There was a lot of and then they built this town. I talked to my kid for a little bit. It's similar to what happened in Newfoundland with British interests. The Hammersmith Bullwater built a physical ground policy. They essentially made sure that they have the supply of newsprint, regardless in the case of the First World War. But in this case, it was just, you know, exploitation. But they didn't actually use that. It wasn't the bad outsiders. This was a good investment. We need this. It was more about these people trying to struggle. It was more about the hard scrabble lives of these people, and they're doing desperate acts. And so, yeah, you don't get the companies involved a little bit, but not so much the corporate issues. I mean, that really is as much as you think.
Well, our time has elapsed. I thank all four of you very much. And I thank you very much for staying here.